Ms. Foreman is now Assistant Secretary of Agriculture for Food and Consumer Services. So without further ado, Carol Tucker Foreman.
Thank you very much. I thought I would talk for a very short period of time, and maybe we could talk to each other for the rest of the period of time. It's obviously very exciting for me to be here and to be part of the Women's Conference. It's also kind of a nice change because you're not like the groups that I've been making speeches to recently. In the last couple of months, had the honor to speak to the American Meat Institute and the Texas Cattle Feeders Association and the Poultry and Egg Institute and an association of food distributors, and there were very few women in the audience at any of those events. As a matter of fact, the lack of women in the audience at events like that may be somewhat something of an explanation of why my appointment as Assistant Secretary of Agriculture was as controversial as it was. When President Carter announced his intention to appoint me, there were a number of cries of anguish heard in Washington. And Earl Butz, I'm sure you remember him, even ventured to say that my appointment was an insult to the American farmer. And that bothered me because everybody knows that Earl Butz is the world's greatest living expert on insults, and I was concerned about that. It's true that I'm not like my predecessors. Thank you. With my voice, you don't need much help. You can still hear me out there, can't you? They still hear me next door? Okay. There were a lot of cries that I wasn't qualified to be Assistant Secretary of Agriculture, and that concerned me some because I'd spent about 17 years in government and in Washington as a lobbyist for a variety of causes, and I certainly thought I was qualified to be Assistant Secretary of Agriculture. It seems that if you set, though, the qualifications for this job as those held by my predecessors, then you might question whether or not I was qualified for the job, because I am certainly not like the people who held the job before me. First of all, I don't have a degree in agricultural economics, and all my predecessors had had degrees in agricultural economics. And it's important to have a degree in agricultural economics if you're going to run the food stamp program. I'm not sure why that's true, but certainly that was an opinion widely held in Washington. I had never worked for an agribusiness corporation either, as had most of my predecessors. And, of course, most of all, I wasn't a man, as had been all of my predecessors. All of those things that, of course, then raised concern in many people's minds about my qualifications were, I think, precisely the ones that made my appointment by President Carter and Secretary Berglund a certainty, because they had made it clear, the President had made it clear, that he was anxious to bring people who had been critics of government into government, and the Secretary has made it very clear that he's out to change the way the Department of Agriculture had been run for the past few years. You know, when Abraham Lincoln established the Department of Agriculture, he referred to it as the People's Department. And over the years, that view of the department has declined. It was the People's Department. That was a pretty accurate thing to call it when 30% of the folks out there were urban and 70% of the folks were rural. And as the population has changed from rural to urban, the view of the Department of Agriculture as representing a very small minority of people in the United States has grown and grown and grown. And the last couple of secretaries of agriculture had encouraged that view of the department. Secretary Berglund has felt that it's important that the department be viewed once again as the department of all the people. And I think that that's appropriate. I suspect that most people, when they think about the Department of Agriculture, think of price supports and the Soil Conservation Service and the Cooperative Extension Service. And it may come as a surprise to you to know that two-thirds of the Department of Agriculture's total budget is in programs that relate to consumers. They're in the food stamp programs, primarily in the food stamp program, in other domestic feeding programs, and in the programs involved with food safety and quality and with human nutrition research. I'd like to, I have jurisdiction, incidentally, over the food stamp program and the school lunch program and school breakfast, and a program I'd like to tell you about today called the Women, Infant, Children Feeding Program, which I think is a very, very important one, and over those programs in the Food Safety and Quality Service that are responsible for meat and poultry inspection and for the grading of most of the food that we eat. All of that adds up to about $9 billion a year, and I think in those two organizations under my jurisdiction there are about 9,000 employees, most of them meat and poultry inspectors. I think that the programs are especially relevant to women. The food stamp program, as you know, was started in 1964 in the darkest days of inflation and high unemployment in 1974-75. There were as many as 19 million people receiving food stamps in the United States. Today, the economy is a little better, and unemployment's gone down a little bit, and there are only 16.7 million people on food stamps. It's a program that I hope will continue to shrink for that reason. Over 70% of food stamp households are headed by women who are the sole source of support for their families. And the typical woman recipient lives with two dependents on an income of about $300 a month, obviously a figure substantially below the poverty level. The food stamp program is likely to bring her benefits, if she's an average woman on the program, of about $71 a month. Obviously, in this way, the program works to relieve the association that has always existed between single women heading households and poverty. There are a lot of changes coming in the food stamp program. It's a program that had lost a lot of credibility with American people. And I guess over the past few years, I never saw a food stamp headline that wasn't negative. It was a program that perhaps had not been very well administered. It certainly didn't have the support of the last administration. But the reason the food stamp rolls grew so large is because people were in need. If we hadn't had a high unemployment rate, a rate that was sometimes up to 9%, if you hadn't had a 40% increase in food prices in a three-year period, the food stamp program probably would have stayed rather small. It expanded because the need for it expanded horribly during the years between 1973 and the present. And as I say, I hope now that it will continue to reduce itself as the economy grows better. But a program that grows that large obviously begins to show the strains of any inadequacies in its structure, and there were a lot of inadequacies in the food stamp program structure. Congress passed last summer, and the president signed in September, a new food stamp reform law that we believe will make it possible to restore credibility to the food stamp program and that will make it serve people that it has never served before, the very poorest of the poor, and particularly the poorest of the working poor. We've eliminated the purchase requirement for food stamps. In the past, if you wanted food stamps, if you qualified for them, you went in and you paid your money, and you got back an amount of food stamps equivalent to that money plus a bonus. In other words, you might have gone in and paid $60 and gotten $100 worth of food stamps. Today, with the passage of the new law, if you're qualified for food stamps, you go in and pay nothing and get only $40 worth of food stamps. In other words, we've eliminated the transaction that represented the $60. You get fewer stamps. We're going to save about $50 million a year in just plain administrative costs for not having to print the food stamps, those additional stamps, circulate them, account for them. It removes an enormous incentive to fraud that had existed before, because we had to go out in low-income areas and find people to sell food stamps. And too frequently, the money that was exchanged for the food stamps didn't get back to Washington. I think that it will go a long way toward restoring credibility in the program. But the most important thing about eliminating the purchase requirement is that you know that fewer than 60% of the people who are eligible for food stamps actually participate in the food stamp program. And the single largest reason for not participating is the inability to come up with the purchase price. And this is particularly true among the working poor, people who get a small check each week, have to pay rent, have to pay utilities, and don't have enough money left over to buy food. And last year, in the middle of that miserable winter that we had, there were a lot of people throughout the country who had to make a choice. They could have electricity or they could have food, but they didn't get both last winter. When the new food stamp program goes into effect next July, we think that we'll be past that particular problem. I'd also like to talk to you, as I mentioned, about a program that I think is particularly important to women, the Women, Infant, Children Supplemental Feeding Program. Every study that we have indicates that there is a terribly close relationship between the adequacy of a woman's diet during pregnancy, during the time she's nursing, and the adequacy of the diet of a young child and that child's health and well-being later in life. The relationship between nutrition during pregnancy and during the first few months and years of life and the adult human being's health and well-being are very close. The United States, with all of its incredible health facilities, ranks 16th out of developed countries in infant mortality rates. We still have babies dying in the United States for inadequate food during the mother's pregnancy. We still have children who grow to adults, suffering mental retardation as a result of inadequate nutrition during pregnancy and the early years of life. The WIC program, as we call it, is designed to attack that problem, to attack the basic relationship between poor nutrition and poverty. There are about 300 counties right now operating WIC programs, and it's a very special program. A woman comes in to a health clinic to enroll in a prenatal health care program, and she then becomes eligible for a voucher. And the voucher can be exchanged in the local supermarket for a diet that's high, for foods that are high in calcium and vitamin C and vitamin A and iron. You can get cereal and milk and cheese and bread and eggs with these vouchers. And in the areas where they've had the WIC program operating, we've found an increase in that population in the weight of babies at birth and an increase in head circumference, which is one of the standards that are checked in looking for healthy babies, and a decrease in infant morbidity and mortality. The program appears to have an enormous capacity to influence the well-being of thousands of young babies. The only problem with the WIC program right now is that it doesn't operate in enough areas. As I say, it operates in only 300 counties throughout the United States right now. The WIC legislation was enacted, I believe, 5 years ago, and the last group of folks at the Department of Agriculture didn't care much for the program. It was a congressional initiative. And so Congress passed it, and the Department of Agriculture dutifully ignored it. And they were sued, and the judge said, thou must stop ignoring the WIC program, and began to carry it out, and they did grudgingly. And then they were sued again, and they got a little more enthusiastic about it. But it's only been in the last year, and particularly since we came into the WIC program, that it has begun to grow and grow. And next year it's up for renewal. The legislation has to be renewed, and I can assure you that the Carter administration will support its renewal, and we hope that women all across the country will also support its renewal. We're a country that talks a lot about being pro-life and pro-family, and I suspect that people who talk about being pro-life and pro-family can ill afford not to support programs that provide the very basic necessities of life to low-income women and their children. I think one important point about the WIC program that I wanted to mention is that we're now starting a pilot project for migrant women. One of the areas where our health care system has lagged worst is for migrant women who start out down here in Texas and work their way up through Arkansas and Illinois and up even into Minnesota and all out through the country bringing in crops. Many of them start out pregnant down here, and the baby may be born along the way. You may be eligible for health care in Texas and not eligible for health care or for the WIC program in Illinois or in Minnesota. We have a pilot project where we're going to trace women through the migrant stream, give them a card when they start out down here in Texas, that will make them eligible to participate in the WIC program no matter where they are, all the way up through the migrant stream. And in addition, we'll be trying to set up more WIC clinics that will be in areas where we know that there's a heavy migrant population. Very briefly, I also administer the school lunch program, and every day my children come home and tell me that it's a disaster, at least in their school. And we're trying to do something about that. I ate the school lunch, I'm sure, for about 12 years, and it was always terrible wherever I ate it. I think there's a way to break the string of inedible, unattractive, and, God help us, sometimes non-nutritious school lunches. And we're trying to do that. We're trying to do it by changing the menus, by giving schools more flexibility in what they serve. But none of those things will really do the job. I think we've got some proposed new regulations for school lunch, and I think the most important thing about them is that for the first time, they will require that school food service personnel involve students and their parents in the school lunch program and in the planning of the program and in the planning of the menus. Every place where it's done, the school lunch is very successful. In Milwaukee, they do it. In Las Vegas, they do it. In Scarsdale, they do it. And when the kids know, when they have the opportunity to express their desires to the school food service personnel, and where those people are creative enough and interested enough to do what is clear that the children want, the program improves. However, and I urge you to go back to your cities and towns if your kids don't like the school lunch and get involved with your local school board and with the school lunch program, because there are some things we can't do anything about. And one of them is the surroundings in which the school lunch is served. If it's in a dingy, nasty basement where the kids have to stand in line for 20 minutes and then their play period is reduced to about 5 or 10 minutes on the other end, of course they're not going to eat the lunch. They're going to grab it and get the hell out just as fast as they can. We've discovered something that I suspect all parents know, and probably most just rational individuals. If you feed kids before they have their recess period, they're very anxious after being cooped up all morning to go outside and play. If you let them go outside and play first, and then you feed them, they're a lot hungrier, first of all, and there's a lot less reluctance to stay there and finish the meal because they haven't been out to play yet. We'll be trying to encourage schools to do that, too. Another program that comes within the Food and Nutrition Service is the Child Care Feeding Service that operates year-round in daycare centers and Head Start centers and family daycare homes. And once again, this provides at least one warm, nutritious meal to children every day. There's another area that I don't have responsibility for, but the Department of Agriculture does, and it's one that I think is going to play an important, more and more important role in our lives as we go along, and that's human nutrition research. The Department of Agriculture for years has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on research, and other government agencies, of course, too. The only trouble is that after all these years, we know a lot more about how to feed a lactating cow efficiently and effectively than we do about how to feed a lactating woman efficiently and effectively. And if you look at the proportion of money spent on dairy research as opposed to that spent on human nutrition research, you'll understand why it is that we know a lot more about one than about the other. The number of dollars has paid off in direct proportion to or the information's paid off in direct proportion to the number of dollars invested. Secretary Berglund is anxious to begin a more expanded program of human nutrition research. There's really so much we still don't know. We know about recommended daily allowances for a number of vitamins, but we don't know what the necessary daily amount of a number of trace minerals, for example, is. We don't know what the difference in the dietary needs of a 12-year-old boy are from a 40-year-old woman. We don't know what kind of nutrition is necessary in order to feed people to get them to have the highest possible level of health and performance. Those are all things that we don't know. We don't know a lot about fat in the diet. We're beginning to learn a little more. There's still a lot we don't know. A lot of recent studies indicate a very close relationship between degenerative disease and adequacy of nutrition. We don't know very much about that. We don't know very much about a lot of things that are important on a day-to-day basis to those of us sitting here in the room. For example, what impact women going into the workforce in larger numbers has had on the kinds of meals that their families eat. Is nutrition substantially less adequate today that we live in McDonald's, hamburgers, carryouts than it was when there was a mother at home feeding a nuclear family? All of our data still presume that mommy stays home and fixes dinner for the family every evening, although all of us know that that's true on a very few days and very few families, regardless of whether or not the mother works. We don't know why people choose the foods that they choose. We don't know what taste properties or smell or what packaging or what advertising does to influence the choices that people make with regard to their food and what that does with regard to the adequacy of their diet. I guess what I'm saying is that women need to be very much more involved in food policy. Food policy, agriculture policy, like most government policy, has been primarily made by men. I was next door a few minutes ago, and someone was asking how many women Jimmy Carter had brought into the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and I couldn't wait until somebody asked that question over here. I'm going to wait until somebody does. But food policy has clearly been made primarily by men, and women need to get very much more into it. There's a great deal of dissatisfaction with government today. People think government's no good and that it can't possibly work and it can't possibly work well. And every time I hear that, I'm reminded that back in 1952, there was a similar period when people were largely disgruntled and disgusted with the adequacy of their governmental institutions. And Adlai Stevenson was running for president, and he said, "Government's like a pump, and what it pumps up is a pretty fair reflection of the people it represents, no better and no worse." And I think that to the extent then that we sit around and say that our government stinks, we're making some fairly strong comments about the people that it represents. And I think to the extent that we find that food policy, like any other government policy, has been inadequate, it perhaps is because there haven't been enough of us concentrating on it, watching the government folk who make the decisions and urging them to make different decisions. And I would welcome your support over the next 4 years in watching federal food policy very, very closely. I'll be glad to take your questions. Yes, ma'am. Well, first of all, it's only operating in 300 counties because it's a new program. It just got started. We're starting new WIC clinics as we can, but primarily it only operates in 300 counties because the Department of Agriculture dug in its heels and refused to open WIC clinics for several years until ordered to do so by the federal district court.
They just didn't allocate funds and resources.
That's right. They impounded the funds. We now have the clinic numbers are growing very rapidly, and we have a system that's one of the best ones that I've run into, and the federal government was there before I came. And as a result of the court order, we go through and we look at the amount of money spent each quarter in each state, and if a state hasn't spent all its money in that quarter that was allocated to it for the WIC program, it has to send the money back to Washington, and then that pot of money is divided up and sent out to those states that used all their WIC money. So there's this incentive to serve as many women as possible, because the more you serve, the more money will come back to you, and the less you serve, then you have to give up those funds. We're hoping that the program will be able to be expanded. Yes, ma'am.
I want to talk about your school lunch program. I noticed I'm from Boulder, Colorado, and one of the concerns during the 1950s in Boulder was the fact that when they changed the lunch program, a lot of the mothers thought that the dessert was the most important part of the diet, and to get a child to eat, he needed the sugar. And I noticed that in the last 10 years, since we have quite a number of counterculture or hippies that went back to eating natural foods the way grandmother did in 1820, where they eat lots of oatmeal and lots of raisins, lots of nuts, that they look like healthier people after a 10-year period, even though they live in unheated homes and they don't see doctors very often. They do come down with things. Since diabetes does run in a lot of Caucasian families, and sugar is, if you have it from a very early age, a very high incidence of diabetes at an early age, it does sound rather ridiculous in some school lunch programs where families are not exposed to the old oatmeal philosophy. But that's what grandmother served for a very good reason. You could live. Oatmeal had a fiber in it that absorbed things, and they kept sugar away. And we're concerned about generations of people that after 20 years of, not only is it an alcoholic diet, because I did learn that in our medical clinic, a lot of the things that they're putting in, like hamburgers and milkshakes and all that, are diabetic, not just diabetic pro diets, but they also are potential alcoholics. And we have alcohol abuse. I taught in a school where the children on the lunch break took speed, and they were only in third grade. It was a frightening experience for me. So I
I share your concern about high sugar, high fat diets, and all the studies that we're getting lead us to be concerned about it. Let me tell you what we're doing. We just started, and obviously that's still a big problem. In the new proposed school lunch regulations, we have instructed school lunch officials to try to reduce levels of salt, which is also a serious problem in the American diet, the levels of sugar, and the levels of fat. We're requiring schools to offer a low-fat milk in addition to regular milk in an attempt to, so that those children who want to get a lower-fat diet can get a lower-fat diet, and that's a fairly easy way to do it. And yet the child who needs the additional nutrition won't be denied it, because if that's your one meal of the day, you may be needing to get that. The school lunch program has several components. It has to have vegetables, and it has to have protein, and so on and so forth. It does not have to have a dessert. Desserts are something added by the local school system in the hopes of getting more children to participate in the diet. So we have